This is Popular Front, a podcast focused on the niche details of modern warfare and underreported conflict with me, Jake Hanrahan. Today we speak to journalist Ali Winston about the unique militarization of the Oakland police force, which began when the Black Panthers in the US began to start arming themselves to fight back against police violence. Since then, the militarization's only got bigger and bigger. Ali's going to explain how this all played out with the backdrop of serious police corruption in Oakland. If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please do support us at patreon.com/popularfront or buy our merchandise at popularfront.shop. So you've written this book, and a lot of it deals with corruption, the militarization of the Oakland police force, various issues there. Now, as we know, the militarization of the police in the US is nothing new, but it seems like a lot of this, the real over-the-top shit, really started with the Oakland police. Tell us about that. Why is it?
This book, the writers come out at night. My colleague Darwin Bond-Graham and I spent probably the better part of 20 years combined, over 20 years combined, actually reporting on this city and ins and outs of law enforcement and the criminal justice system there. And Oakland is actually, in many ways, a little bit of a bellwether for American law enforcement. It's in a city that's about 400,000 people large. It's a port city, multiracial, very blue-collar, and it has dealt with, experienced a lot of the major tumult that most American cities of its size have in the past century or so. Because most American cities are not New York or Los Angeles or Houston, they're actually about several hundred to a couple hundred thousand people large. So in a way, Oakland is more representative than Los Angeles or Chicago or some of those other places. Oakland is one of the places on the West Coast that that industrialized earlier than later because the Transcontinental Railroad ended there. The city's history only goes back to about 1852 or so, so it makes it a very young city from a European context. But the Transcontinental Railroad ended there, and a lot of primary resource industries and shipping concentrated in the Bay Area. And since it's on the actual useful side of the Bay, San Francisco's on the West Bay on the peninsula. That's actually it's not as easy to connect to the rest of the country from. There's no direct rail link. Oakland was a very, turned into a very blue-collar city and had a ton of migrants from all over the U.S., South Central Europe, China in particular, and the Chinese were crucial in building the West Coast. And the police department in Oakland actually evolved in conjunction with this period with the kind of mission of protecting private property of the Anglo elite that lived in the city's hills and with controlling restive social classes. In some ways, it's actually less of a, it doesn't have the same kind of foundational myth of being a department aimed at, or an agency aimed at slave catching, like a lot of East Coast and Southeastern U.S. departments do. But because I want to fast forward a little bit, because the West Coast turned into a huge garrison in the World War II era, it was basically the launching point for the Pacific Theater, and the U.S. engaged in a very brutal war against the Japanese Empire in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Police departments had experienced a very strong knock-on effect from that up-armoring of American society and the just massive growth of the military. You got to remember, our military was smaller than Portugal's military before World War II, and afterwards, you know, it turned into the Pentagon turned into the behemoth that it is today. So, you know, the police department was always used to repress subversive elements like anarchists, communists. They were rounded up very heavily during the Palmer raids in the 1920 era. They were used to basically raid and extort the Chinese population before World War I, after the Great Earthquake sent most of, destroyed San Francisco in 1906 and sent tremendous numbers of people across the bay into Oakland. But really, when you start to see the Oakland police adopt a little bit more of a military character is right after the war. So in 1946, you know, after demobilization draws down, there's a lot of people who had moved to the West Coast to work in these massive shipyards and ordnance factories that lined the Bay Area, especially the East Bay. Those went out of business, and a lot more people were on. They were experiencing, you know, wage decreases, inflation was out of control, and there was a lot of labor militancy around the country. This is also an era when the Communist Party and a lot of left-wing movements were still quite strong in the U.S., and Oakland was actually the scene of the last general strike in the United States in 1946. There were massive strikes, and the downtown shopping district, the downtown business district, was actually blockaded by striking workers. In order to break this strike, the Oakland Police Department, which included at that point a number of people who had demobilized from a local army base, there was a massive army base in West Oakland that stayed open until the mid-1990s, the police department got hold of a couple Browning machine guns, wheeled them into the middle of downtown Oakland, set them up at key intersections, and escorted these scab workers into the stores and businesses under that protection. So that's kind of the first sign you see of this real switch. And then the next moment, next really big moment of change occurs in the 1960s with the rise of radical left-wing movements like the Black Panthers. And the Black Panthers originated in Oakland. They were founded as a movement for community control of the police. So Oakland's African-American population exploded during World War II. There was a massive migration of blacks from the South and Southeast, mainly to Oakland. They came, and the West Coast, they mainly came from Texas and Louisiana. They followed the railroads across the southern border of the U.S. and up through San Diego, Los Angeles, and Oakland, all the way up to Seattle, actually. That's where the West Coast African-American population came from, by and large. And at first, you know, the city fathers in Oakland were like, oh, well, you know, they'll live in the ghetto and they'll be here for a few years and they'll go home. But it became very quickly apparent that, you know, you come to the West Coast, there's all this sunshine, there's all this money flying around, there's work, there's opportunity. A lot of these people were not going to go back home to Jim Crow Texas or Louisiana. So very rapidly, the Oakland police, the Oakland fathers that be, the city fathers, essentially said, you know, we need to change our police department's composition. We need to have a much more heavy-handed, sharp-edged police department that knows how to police black folk. And those are their, you know, I'm paraphrasing their words. And Oakland had a pretty nasty history of prejudice beforehand. In the 1920s, there was a massive KKK presence in Oakland that at that point in time was really aimed at control, at countering Catholic and Jewish influence. African-American, they didn't like African-Americans, but that wasn't their main concern. And the West Coast Klan was a really big thing in the 1920s and 30s. Very strong law enforcement component there. A lot of cops were part of it. And in the 1950s, late 40s, early 50s, you got to see that the Oakland Police Department pulled a lot of new recruits from recently demobilized soldiers from the South, and they wanted people who had hardcore attitudes towards African-Americans and basically tolerated open racism, heavy-handed, jackbooted policing aimed at keeping blacks in line. You know, we detail a lot of this history in our book, and that kind of lays the ground, you know, summary execution of people running away from burglaries or, you know, pickpocketing or stuff like that. And that is the kind of underpinning of the social atmosphere that gives birth to the Black Panthers. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale founded the party in, I believe, 65? Yeah, 1965 in North Oakland. And their entire idea was to counter the police and make sure that they were policing, that they weren't abusing black folk, that they were they would monitor patrols, they would basically drive around with a scanner, look for police stops, and get out and record them on Super 8 footage, take photographs of them, and harangue them about, you know, the illegality of the stop or whatever action they were doing, and they were armed. And that's the key component, is they made a decision to confront law enforcement with weapons, and this terrified the police department.
But they were doing that legally at that time, right?
It was legal, yeah. It was entirely legal.
It's the thing of, I know, like, a lot of those people around that time were very, like, yeah, Second Amendment, you know, it's fine, we want guns. But then as soon as the black people have the guns, suddenly they don't want the Second Amendment no more.
That's right. And the important thing is that they adopted this tactic of arming themselves from The Deacons of Defense and other self-protection organizations that African Americans in the South, the American South, founded in the 50s and 60s when, you know, there were lynchings, car bombings, just atrocities being wreaked on the black community by the white status quo down there. And this terrified law enforcement, and they quickly realized the local police department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other law enforcement agencies around the state, they realized very quickly that they had to do something differently now. And this is happening at the same time the Panthers are spreading down to Los Angeles. They had a major chapter down there that also incorporated youth from the local street gangs. Same thing happened in Oakland, but the gangs in Los Angeles that they became part, that joined up with the Panthers, were things like the Slawsons, very famous organizations that kind of prefigured the Crips and what would become the Crips and the Bloods later. And the Panthers were open about that. They wanted to recruit brothers from the block. They wanted to have people who were had come back from Vietnam or had familiarity with weapons, and you know, were not just, they wanted to recruit the lumpen proletariat. But by this token, law enforcement also treated them differently. They saw them as a communist, a Marxist-Leninist organization intent on overthrowing the government. There's some truth to the Marxist-Leninist aspect, certainly. The Panthers did, you know, distribute Mao's Little Red Book and had that ideology and did see themselves as part of an internationalist, an international movement at the time in the mid-60s. But the police department in Oakland quickly established an intelligence. They adapted their intelligence bureau to basically keep very close tabs on the Panthers. They assembled files on each member of the party and just, you know, shared those with the FBI, of course. They had vehicle lists that their patrol officers were issued on clipboards of known vehicles to be associated with the Black Panthers. They would pull them over, and they'd had a special radio code that they'd call in. There was a captain as well in the police department, Captain Brown, who trained other law enforcement agencies around California on how to respond to the Panthers and kind of demonstrated the Oakland Police Department's methods for dealing with not only Panthers, but the anti-war radicals as well that were really, you know, setting the world alight at the University of California, Berkeley's campus just up the road. So the history, and I'm going to cut this one a little bit short because it's very, very detailed, and you know, we have two chapters on this essentially in the book. But the Panthers essentially entered into a shooting war not just with the Oakland Police Department but with the United States government. And they were absolutely baited. The counterintelligence program that the FBI ran did seed a lot of bad blood between Panthers and other radical organizations, did make the Panthers out to be a bigger threat than they were. But the Panthers also went looking for confrontations with the cops and did shoot it out with them. Huey Newton was put on trial for killing a police officer, John Frey, during a traffic stop in Oakland and wounding another one. He also was shot. He ended up beating his court case on that after a couple years of really intense trial. But there was also, you know, the killing of Bobby Hutton, who, along with Eldridge Cleaver, were holed up in a house after going out and looking for cops to take shots at and ambushing a bunch of them. And then they were cornered in a house, gassed out of there, and then Hutton was actually, they were exited the building naked, and Hutton was executed at gunpoint by several Oakland police officers in cold blood. So they were, at the same time as this intelligence and intelligence gathering apparatus is kind of evolving in Oakland and the shooting war is happening, down in Los Angeles, the LAPD was perfecting the SWAT team tactics, special weapons and techniques team, the kind of entry style police unit that now has become ubiquitous with urban warfare. It's kind of one of these feedback loops between law enforcement and the military, whereby military tactics used for clearing, you know, small unit that's used to clear close quarters. And what would have been an urban combat situation is then adapted for use in the urban setting. And in Los Angeles, they famously, the Panther chapter there, gets into a shootout with the LAPD SWAT team in 1969 during a raid. And it's a massive raid by dozens of officers. The Panthers are holed up in their headquarters, and there's just a fusillade. You know, just an absolute, there were 40 members of the SWAT team there, and the Panthers are holed up in this house in South Central, an African American area, in December. And it's just an incredibly, incredibly hectic confrontation. And that really kind of sets in motion this whole, you know, tension with the Panthers and other New Left. This sets in motion this radicalization of police departments that, frankly, they were already quite reactionary. But now they, you know, there is this long-seated culture of like Klan membership, John Birch Society, the anti-communist conspiratorial organization had very deep tentacles in law enforcement. But during this period, the mid to late 60s, that's when the police departments throughout the country pretty much react to the situation in Oakland and Los Angeles and the confrontations elsewhere with New Left radicals and Black radicals and really start to militarize. They cannot, they are basically of the mentality that they cannot be caught out like this again.
So at this point is when they kind of got hold of a lot more weaponry and machinery, right? Things that they hadn't previously had.
That's right. This is also during, it's right in the middle of the American, if you will, surge in Vietnam, the late 1960s. So there are a lot of people, you know, we still had a draft. We were in a very hot shooting war there. And there's a ton of equipment. There's a ton of logistics just circulating throughout the U.S. Their police departments are getting surplus rifles. They're getting, you know, helicopters that were put into use in Vietnam or manufactured for Vietnam and now being surplused out or sold as scrap to back to the U.S. and then repurposed for police departments. You start to see armored vehicles around this period of time as well, too, for entry. And there's just, the country is awash in guns. And this trend actually does continue right through the 1970s, where you experience a lot of deindustrialization. There's inflation. The economy starts to go into a tailspin a little bit. And you start to see the rise of large-scale narcotics trafficking and the underground economy to replace the jobs that were lost during the deindustrialization that really began in the 1960s and gathered pace in the 1970s. So by the late 70s, early 80s, Oakland's streets have this very intense character. It's always been an area where you can buy narcotics going back to the 19th century. But because it's a port city, it has that function. The port containerizes. There's no longer break bulk loads. So things are getting shipped over in these big sealed metal boxes that are very hard to inspect. And God knows what comes over from them. You have a lot of people who served in Southeast Asia. Soldiers had established, you know, connections with drug traffickers over there. Heroin starts to flood into the U.S. That's a real, that's kind of the, I guess, one of the bigger heroin epidemics of the 20th century happened in conjunction with our deep involvement with the Vietnam War. And you start to see street-level trafficking organizations emerge, like Felix Mitchell's 6ix9ine mob. Felix Mitchell was a very prominent drug lord in East Oakland. A lot of popular culture about, you know, the bling flashing, fancy car driving, murderous, you know, drug lord, drug kingpin that emerged in popular culture in like the 1980s and 90s. There are many people that figure into it, but Felix Mitchell was the first that really hit the national stage. And he actually got his start as a junior Panther. He was one of these young Black kids that grew up in deep East Oakland, in East Oakland, and grew up as a youth member of the Panthers and looked up to the organization. They were doing a lot of social work in the city. But another thing also existed in the Panthers too, alongside the school that they ran, the breakfast programs, the medical clinics they ran. When Huey Newton got out of prison, he actually disarmed. There was a big split in the Panthers, and he disarmed the rest of the party that stayed loyal to him. There was an east-west split between people loyal to Newton and people loyal to Eldridge Cleaver. The Cleaver folks later became the Black Liberation Army, and that's another story. But Huey basically dissolved every Panther chapter around the country except for Oakland and said, if you're loyal to me, come back to Oakland. We're going to build our survival programs. We're going to build our political power here. And they did that, and that's actually a big way in which Oakland's African-American population became, rose to, you know, win positions on the city council, and Mayor Lionel Wilson became the city's first Black mayor in the 1970s. But Huey disarmed everybody else in the party, gave his bodyguards, who he called the Squad or the Buddha Samurai, firearms, and they essentially ran protection rackets on prostitution and narcotics all throughout Oakland. And Felix Mitchell earned his turf in Oakland by shooting it out with Huey's bodyguards for control of certain markets and in certain areas of the city. And by the mid-1980s, between 1960 and 1980, the city's violent crime rate increases by 500 to 700%. You went from seeing 20 homicides a year to seeing over 100. Seeing maybe 100 rapes to 400 rapes. It was a very, very, very tough period. The city's population decreased by about 30,000. The white population dropped by almost 40%. There was huge white flight as a result of, you know, redlining goes away, so neighborhoods start to integrate. There are people who don't want to live next to African Americans, so they leave for the suburbs, and they don't want to be around the violence and the tumult of this era. And during all this, the police department is dealing with budget cuts and so forth, but they're also receiving a lot of federal grant incentive and money to build these counter-narcotics units, counter-gang units, to go after these large drug trafficking enterprises. And the war on drugs in the 1980s really does kind of represent this interesting moment whereby paramilitary units in the law enforcement expands out from the SWAT team, and you start to see drug cops, who previously would do buy bust and, you know, be involved in kind of vice-style enforcement, they get the same type of training, right? And because the street gangs are out there with Uzis and you know, 45 caliber pistols and rifles, the cops start to wear heavier body armor, start to, you know, more cops are trained with rifles, more trained in terms of search and entry tactics. So it turns into essentially an arms race, whereby at the juncture of the early 1990s in Oakland, you really have a department that is entirely equipped to get into a shooting war with a very heavily armored drug organization. And that only happens one or two times, where you had these large-scale shootouts, but they were in the situation where the city was experiencing like 150, 160 homicides on a bad year, and there were bad years in the early 1990s. And, you know, the police department would engage in 10, 15 shootings a year, police shootings involving suspects who were armed and unarmed, almost all black. And this is, you know, eliding the history of police, pushback to police excesses and calls for police reform that really makes up the core of our book. But the bottom line is that the police department in Oakland militarized in direct line with the situations that they were encountering, both with the new left in order to kind of maintain their mission of suppression and control of the new left and black radicals and the African-American population. And then they also kind of evolve on a parallel track. They up armor as a result of the drug war and the massive influx of cocaine and heroin into the country. And the cocaine influx of the 1980s, by the way, is very tied in with the Iran-Contra operation and the entire pipeline that American-sponsored proxies in Central America set up.
Rest in peace, Gary Webb.
Rest in peace, Gary Webb. There are many reporters of a certain generation in the Bay Area who did not like him. I rubbed up against some of them during my career out there, but he was right. And his book is a brilliant book, Dark Alliance. It was a brilliant book.
Yeah. Always his kind of reporting was always going to be disliked by, you know, game players and good boys. But yeah, anyway, so how then did the Oakland police get all of this stuff? Because it's one thing to be like, okay, we need more weapons because we're coming up against more violence, which in turn, whether it's created or not created, or, you know, whichever way it came from, it makes sense, you know, just on a level of this, we need more weapons, whatever, to their superiors is what I'm saying. But then how do they end up with literal military vehicles or like military class vehicles to use in civilian areas?
Well, there's several ways in which this happens. And they all really trace back to the federal government and the federal government dumping money into law enforcement as part of its program of adjusting to, this is kind of like what happens in the Nixon era, end of the Johnson presidency and the beginning of the Nixon presidency. The Great Society, which is Lyndon B. Johnson's answer to the New Deal, is trimmed back as the, you know, quote-unquote silent majority, as many Americans, conservative Americans, react extremely negatively to the student upheavals and racial justice movements of the mid and late 1960s, and call for law and order. So the social programs get slashed back. Conservatives rise to the power in not just California, where Ronald Reagan becomes governor and mounts a war against left-wing radicals and the higher education system that he viewed as, you know, being a little bit too subversive and subject to communist influence. But on a national level, you start to see a drawback of social programs, and that's replaced by funding for law enforcement and for a militarized model of law enforcement that is aimed at social control. And in time, through the 1980s, when there's a massive increase in, you know, gun violence and drug violence does increase because there's a lot of social dissolution that goes along with, you know, deindustrialization, mass unemployment, and the neoliberal project that swept across the country. And you start to see this conservative backlash, and a ton of money gets thrown into police departments from the federal government in the form of justice assistance grants and other streams of funding from DOJ to local police departments to buy bulletproof vests, to buy helmets, to buy long rifles. There are programs, surplus programs, that, you know, allocate, that allow for the transfer of vehicles like Humvees and certain types of helicopters and motorcycles to police departments. This, I believe, that Radley Balco reported on one stream that I think was established in the 1990s, the 1033 program, in his book, The Rise of the Warrior Cop. But it's really driven from on a kind of nationwide policy level from the top down. And by the 1990s, and, you know, there was a lot of, California experienced a big surge in gang violence in the 1980s that was tied with the drug trade. That triggers a very draconian set of laws, sentencing laws, including the three strikes rule, where for three felonies, you basically get a life sentence, no matter what type of felony you are, violent or nonviolent. No, that's not true. They have to be strike felonies, so it's a certain class. But you have this kind of system set up in California that by the late 90s, early 2000s, is incarcerating almost 200,000 people, or 150,000 people. And it's what the sociologist Ruth Wilson Gilmore termed the golden gulag. So, you know, it's really, it law enforcement turns into not only a project of social, well, it always was a project of social control, but that becomes very apparent in California by the 1980s and 1990s, and the rest of the country followed suit. So it really, by the turn of the century, you know, aside from the drug war style policing, you have this push after 9/11 to quash dissent. And that's where you really see a lot of the big clashes between protesters and law enforcement. Where police just absolutely let trample protesters with horses, tear gas them, and the Port of Oakland in 2003 saw the worst example of brutality towards anti-war demonstrators. In April of 2003, cops tear gassed, beat, arrested demonstrators at the Port of Oakland trying to block a shipment of anti-war material to Iraq, or a shipment of war material to Iraq. And they fired wooden dowels at them. They ran them over with Harley Davidson motorcycles in a tactic they called the bump tactic. And, you know, injured a bunch of longshoremen as well. So, and that pattern would repeat itself again and again in Oakland in the 2000s and 2010s. But it all involved, you know, the players at the heart of this were cops, who are, many of whom I reported on, who had military backgrounds. They had been involved, they had had, you know, certain types of special entry training, some of them were special forces, and they were made up of this hardcore, very valued hardcore of police officers that were recruited for that background. By that juncture, OPD was recruiting for a certain profile of cop. And that's really, that underpins a big part of their culture, their internal culture, is that they wanted people who had a very militarized perspective and training in order to approach policing what, you know, is admittedly a very violent city, but that's how they viewed it. And by the early 2000s, that was very apparent for the casual observer. It's also worthwhile noting that West Coast policing is different than East Coast policing, which is more of like a civil service job. The pay is lower. There's a lot more like graft style corruption, if you will. Out West, police are paid better. Their graft was really kind of It exists, but it's not, doesn't, it didn't play out on the large scale after some of the major reforms of the mid-20th century. Kind of like reformer style police chiefs came in who also were very much straight-laced military types. So there, the out west, the sort of the corruption you see is like really egregious uses of force and just, you know, cops acting like an occupying army. And that's what the Panthers accused the police department of being.
Well, yeah, how did that manifest itself in the more kind of modern era? I know that, I forget which, it was, I think BLM protests where the Oakland police, I remember the footage of them just coming in with like a fucking APC. Like, it was really, really odd to see, I guess, from Britain, you know, because obviously our police are very different. Yeah, how did that manifest itself, I guess, you know, to this day?
Well, I mean, you'll see it. The cops will trot out these Bearcats. They'll ride into the protests on the side of these armored vehicles, and they'll greet glass bottles with, like, shotgun-fired beanbags, quote-unquote beanbags, that's just sacks full of lead. And you'll see them, they'll fire these pepper balls at you with marking dye to try and mark you for later arrest. They sting like a motherfucker. They're made up of CS gas, the same thing that tear gas is made up of. The cops also will fire tear gas at you. They'll throw these canisters, grenades of tear gas, into a demonstration readily. And, you know, New York City is a little, is very different. They don't use tear gas in the same way. They just use mace. And this, like, these launcher-fire tear gas canisters can lodge in your skull. They can crack your head open. And that was very... the demonstrations that I covered in Oakland from like 99, from 2009 through 2019, 18, maybe 20, I wasn't there in 20, that was there in 22, in 20 as well, but they were very hectic, and like you ran a high risk of being wounded if you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. A Marine veteran actually almost died in Oakland. He was in a coma for weeks after getting shot point blank in the head with a shotgun-fired beanbag from about 10 feet away from a riot line during Occupy Oakland. So yeah, it's, you know, it's a sort of city where the issues that later make the national conversation in the U.S., like, you really see them very early in Oakland, and that applies 110% to the militarization of the police.
Yeah. And is the spending, the money that's allocated to these departments, does that ever get cut? Like, if they start using this stuff with excessive force, which obviously they have done and obviously they would, do they then kind of, you know, does the government be like, hey, you're not getting as much money for a tank now or whatever?
No, doesn't get cut. That has to happen on, that has to happen on a federal level. They still get a lot of money from Congress. Congress doesn't really go and parse this out. And there's so much support, you know, the brief moment in 2020 when there was a reckoning about militarization of police and mistreatment of demonstrators, that was very quickly drowned out by a kind of Fox News coordinated tidal wave of, oh, there's crime on the street, there's crime everywhere. And there has been a small uptick in crime thanks to a you know, huge social disruption caused by a one in 100 years, once in a century pandemic. But you know, it's not the early 90s, not even the late 90s anymore in terms of the crime rates. And, you know, the national conversation has unsurprisingly shifted. It might shift back again with this murder of Tyree Nichols in Memphis by a kind of anti-crime unit that was just one of the worst beatings you'll ever see. But I think that there's just a tremendous amount of inertia, and there are very many vested interests who are at this point locked into the idea that police need to be militarized, and they need to be able to, you know, we need to take the cuffs off the police and let them police. And it's kind of this idea of noble cause corruption that really led to the Oakland Police Department being placed under 20 years of federal oversight, because a group of West Oakland cops were outed by a rookie cop for just abusing, God knows, for at least hundreds of West Oakland residents, framing them up, arresting them on false charges, sending them to prison on false charges. And there were a lot of people in the city and the police department who to this day maintain that, well, they were just, you know, they were just dealing with the criminals, and these people got what was coming to them. And yeah, sure, like, does that involve kidnapping people off the streets of West Oakland and beating them for disrespect of cop, beating them so badly on the soles of their feet that they can't walk? No, that's torture. So that's the sort of thing that's like, that's the sort of atmosphere that by the turn of the millennium had been created in Oakland by this process of militarization and this process of, you know, these very kind of disparate strands of events that kind of came together to create the sort of law enforcement that we see today. And, you know, this is a history of a city in 150 years. And there are a lot of different things happening in here, but you're touching on one of the threads that really runs through the heart of it, I think. And that is what a militarized, brutal, lawless police department looks like. And what can be done to change that, or what can't be done to change that.
Right. And your book has come out. I understand it's kind of making some of the cops a little bit nervous. What's happened with that?
Well, it's interesting. Our book came out right when, maybe within a week or so of it coming out, the police chief gets suspended and for covering up an internal affairs scandal that we knew about ahead of time. Darwin and I were aware of it and hinted at it in our conclusion, but because it took some time to come out, and you know, if writing a book, you're not writing a news article, you can't really time everything that fortuitously. But it's gotten decent attention, and what's interesting is a lot of people who used to work in these departments are very receptive to it. Some people who still work there are receptive to it. This will surprise you, but we heard that the head of OPD's Academy wants this to be required reading for incoming cops and is going to buy dozens of copies for rookies. So in some ways it's made some people upset, but it's also, I think there are a lot of people who want to pay attention to the history of this and figure out how to get beyond the current moment we're in and how to get to a better place. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's actually, as much as it's kind of a perverse result, it's a very good one, because there's no point being like, yeah, look, the cops are being fucking scumbags again, surprised. But then nothing happens from it. It's like, well, if they're actually kind of, you know, if they're going to try at least to be like, hey, yeah, we should probably stop this. It's a good thing.
Mm, yeah. No, I think it's getting, hopefully getting to a better place. And I think that if there's any community in the country that is able to get beyond our current paradigm, I think Oakland is probably the best candidate for it.
All right, mate, where can people get this book?
You can order it direct from Simon & Schuster, which is our publisher. They own Atria, which is the imprint. You can go to bookshop.org, which is a wonderful bookstore that gives a percentage of profits to local bookstores. You can get it at your local independent bookstore. If you have to, if you really have to, you can order it from Bezos Core. I would prefer that you didn't, but it's there. It's available everywhere that books are sold. And we really do hope that readers take it with interest and see parallels to Oakland in their own city in the U.S. And perhaps elsewhere. You know, don't know what it's like abroad. I have no idea what the reception is like, but... American law enforcement is pretty influential worldwide, so I think that there are lessons to be learned here for a lot of people, even beyond the U.S.
All right, mate. Well, good luck with that. Where can people get hold of you if they want to?
They can reach me at my email, ali.winston@protonmail.com. I'm on Twitter at awinston, A-W-I-N-S-T-O-N. And if you contact me there, you can get in touch with me via Signal as well. But yeah, that's where I'm at.
All right, mate. Thanks very much, mate.
Cheers, Jake. Thank you so much.
That was journalist Ali Winston speaking about the unique militarization of the Oakland police force and how the uprising of Black Panthers played into all that, leading up to today, where, surprise, the Oakland police force is still extremely militarized. To support us, go to patreon.com/popularfront. For your money, you get a lot more extra every month. That's the way we keep moving forward. Patreon, we don't accept any investment from big corporations, definitely no money from states or anything like that. So the way we keep moving forward is all grassroots. patreon.com/popularfront, or if you want, you can buy our merchandise at popularfront.shop. Thank you very much to the sponsors in this episode. They are Oracle Coffee Shop in Portland, Oregon, USA. They're an independent coffee business selling only fair trade products. See them at 3875 Southwest Bond Avenue, 97239. Also, Grind Core House, a pair of independent coffee shops in Philadelphia, USA. One in South, one in West. You can find them on social media at Grind Core House. And our final sponsor, Propagandopolis, an outlet selling and writing about historical propaganda, war propaganda from around the world. You can buy prints at propagandopolis.com. Use a promo code PopularFront10 for 10% off. Follow us on social media. Check out our documentaries at youtube.com/PopularFront, Instagram at Popular.Front, Twitter at PopularFront _, and TikTok at Popular.Front. Music in this episode, the intro was by Home and the outro was by Sam Black. Listen to his music at samblackpf.com. Thank you very much to our high tier Patreons. They are Viola Forvel, Christian Bustamante, Mike Jones, Britt Richardson, Victor Villa, Daniel Verdin, Margosha, Rohan Irvine, Titus Perkins, Ryan Barbadillo, VS, Brian R, Evan Pank, Bradley Hope, Wizard Actual, Claire Hofbauer, Benjamin Tupper, Chungus Bongwater, Siddhartha O, Damien, Cameron Collins, Nicholas Blomberg, Matthew Diffley, Claire, Liana, Robert, Sean, Christianovich, NTHG, Arturo Rafael Macias, Ethan Zvik, Kefir is the Mind Killer, Gabriel K, Elise Middlefer, David McManus, Tom Petrie, James Leons, Bradley Davies, No Gods, No Dogs, No Hamsters, Brendan Crave, BRX, Ben Marshall, Dallas Dunn, LD50 Seattle The Band, K Glitter Vulcan, Adam H, Derivative Fool, Bottle of Water, Larson 8669, Ivan Julien, Bjorn Kirsten, Diamondstein, Michael O'Connor, Jack Doherty, Nicholas Butter, JD, Jav, James Cully, Tynan Daly, Ethan, Shanklin the Painter, Fitz Madrid, Ed Coulthard, D San, Mike Barone, Ben, Liam Williams, Chris Cusimano, DZA, Giorgio Arani, DR, Amy R, Rubicon, Frank Austin, Amelia Mee, Christina Rivetti, Freya Northman, Nebo, Noah, Andrew Hurley, Vida Provost, Brian McLaughlin, Tom Lockring, Young Wasabi, Tony Bin, JL, Stephen Davila, Dan Dunham, Chad Walker, Lawrence Abrahams, Peter McCormick from What Bitcoin Did, Christopher Martin, Ryan Sandercock, and Moritz Zumbul. Thank you all so much. You're really keeping this moving forward. If you want to support us, patreon.com/popularfront or popularfront.co/support.